Okay, let's move on. The last talk is probably the most complex and most difficult, and it deals with gated perfusion spect. Okay, why do we do gated perfusion spect? Well, I've talked a lot about its use in differentiating artifacts from fixed perfusion abnormalities. So that's very important, but also it has some important clinical implications. This is a nice study from the Journal of Nuclear Medicine looking at cardiac event rate based upon the resting perfusion score. You can see as the defects become more severe, the cardiac event rate increases. Also, as you get more ischemic, the cardiac event rate increases. You're all very familiar with this from this work as well as from Hakamovich's work. But also look at the ejection fraction and its value. As the ejection fraction progressively falls from 50 to 35 to less than 35, look at the dramatic increase in cardiac events. Look at the dramatic increase in cardiac events as the number of hypokinetic segments increases. So, from a prognostic standpoint, our functional information gives us a lot of information, a lot of prognostic value. I don't have the slide here, but if you know Scherrer's work looking at perfusion and function, if you look at that data really carefully, we actually get more prognostic value from the functional information than we do from the perfusion information. So gating has really been very adjunctive to our perfusion scan. Let's just go over some normal studies. This is This is a normal scan, completely normal perfusion at stress and rest. Normal polar maps, function. I use the black and white maps to look at wall motion. You can see the endocardial border very clearly. And again, don't be afraid to use your pointer to assess how well the various walls are moving. Also, in black and white, we can evaluate the right ventricle. You've got to evaluate the right ventricle in more than one projection. It's not like the left ventricle. It's not a prolate ellipse. It's not a bullet. The right ventricle is sort of shaped like a pyramid. So you may not see its maximum contraction in the short axis view, so always go to the horizontal long axis view to look at the right ventricle. Notice that the tricuspid valve plane has a much greater excursion than the mitral valve plane. So that's why you need these two orthogonal views to assess the right ventricle. We planimeter our studies. This is a volumetric technique. Get our ejection fraction. Ejection fractions vary depending upon the software method you use, anywhere between over 50, over 55%. We get diastolic and systolic volumes, 57-19. Normals, generally less than 110 and less than 50. But remember, this is a measure of diastolic volume. What we're really after is diastolic and systolic volume index, which is corrected for patient body surface area. So, obviously, a little lady that's 5 foot tall is not going to have the same volume of some guy who's 6 foot five. So, remember, in our programs, we're just looking at their volumes, not looking at their volume indices. Cardiomyopathy, functional abnormalities, seldom occur with generalized cardiomyopathy, although they may. Cardiomyopathies, small vessel disease, particularly diabetes, hypertension, connective tissue disorders, viral infections, particularly HIV, drug-induced, either by cocaine or cardiotoxic drugs such as adriamycin, postpartum cardiomyopathy, valvular heart disease, and of course, idiopathic cardiomyopathy. What do we see with non-ischemic cardiomyopathy? Generally, we see a fairly homogeneous distribution of tracer throughout the myocardium. Remember that in dilated ventricles, the heart sinks down further in the diaphragmatic crux, and so therefore diaphragmatic attenuation is often accentuated in dilated ventricles. Also, the left ventricular cavity is dilated. What's in the cavity? Blood. Blood is a very effective attenuator. If you look at how the heart sits in the thorax, it's pointed down and to the left. What's the area that is furthest away from the detector in most of the projections? The infraposterior wall. So with dilated cardiomyopathies, we also have attenuation by the cardiac blood pool of the infraposterior wall. So you can get infraposterior apparent perfusion defects in dilated cardiomyopathies, as you see here. Generally, with dilated cardiomyopathies, there tends to be diffuse hypokinesis of the entire left ventricle. Often you get hypokinesis of the right ventricle. How do we differentiate an attenuation artifact from the diaphragm or the blood pool versus an inferior MI? Pretty difficult. The heart's not moving. How can you tell if there's normal inferior wall motion? You can't. So what do you have to do? Either prone imaging or attenuation correction. This is where gating is not very useful in differentiating scar from attenuation when you don't have any wall motion. In this case, ventricles markedly dilated, 208 and 177 diastolic systolic volume, ejection fraction 15%. All right, how do we differentiate non-ischemic cardiomyopathy from ischemic cardiomyopathy? Not very easily. Generally, we have more regional abnormalities. So in this case, in addition to this inferior defect, we also have an anterior defect. We also have an apical defect. Is that exaggerated apical thinning? Sort of tough to tell. But the anterior defect we shouldn't see just with a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. Here, you see the anterior, apical, and inferior defects. Gary Heller and Susan Yao have both published papers that say that if you have more than 15% of the myocardium quantitatively that has perfusion defects, it's more likely to be an ischemic cardiomyopathy versus a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. There's not a magic number, but clearly the bigger the perfusion defects, the more likely you are to have an ischemic cardiomyopathy. With gated imaging, you tend to have more regional abnormalities. So here in this case, in addition to global hypokinesis, you see a more marked abnormality right there in the anterior wall. You see that more localized anterior hypokinesis. So the anterior perfusion defect and the anterior regional wall motion abnormality would favor an ischemic cardiomyopathy. Here, dilated ventricle EF31. Myocardial infarct. Okay. Here you have a fixed perfusion abnormality. Okay. Fixed. Let's take a look at regional wall motion. Look carefully in the LAO view. Here's the perfusion defect. And here you see that akinetic or slightly dyskinetic lateral infralateral wall. You would not see this in color. You need to look at these images in black and white to appreciate wall motion. Perfusion function, EF is 40%, volumes are dilated. Be very, very careful when you're looking at these images. There's frequently tracking problems. We'll talk about that later. But when there's no myocardium, how do you expect the automated programs to detect the endocardial border if there's no myocardium there? So this is just a setup for erroneous edge tracking. Okay. These are all pretty obvious cases. You have a big perfusion abnormality, you have a regional wall motion abnormality. You have normal perfusion, you have relatively normal function. So these are all congruent, but sometimes functional information and perfusion information is not congruent. All right, where are some of these? Okay, where do we have functional abnormalities without perfusion defects? Okay, number one, left bundle branch block. There's nothing wrong with myocardial perfusion other than this really very slight decrease in perfusion that I've described because of the dysynchronous contraction of the septum, but that's pretty trivial. But because of the dysynchrony, you will have a functional abnormality, but no perfusion abnormality. Here's the example. Here's the perfusion scan. The septum looks perfectly fine. Normal perfusion. Normal perfusion. Let's take a look at function. Put your little cursor there. See, the septum is akinetic or mildly dyskinetic. Same here in your vertical long, your horizontal long axis slice. The septum's akinetic to mildly dyskinetic. So here we have a functional abnormality with no perfusion defect. Where do we use color in looking at our gated images? Color allows us to look at wall thickening. Okay? And as you can see, this area of the myocardium is increasing in intensity during systole, indicating normal wall thickening. Well, let me explain this a little more, because this is a very important concept. How do we assess wall thickening by looking at the intensity of the image? This is due to what's called the partial volume effect. Remember, the resolution of a scintillation camera is about 6 millimeters. That's the size of a pixel. We can resolve things within 2 pixels. Well, that's getting to be just about the thickness of the myocardium, about 1.2, 1.5 centimeters. Okay, so therefore, looking at changes in thickness of the myocardium, if an object is less than 2 pixels in dimension, we can't do it. It's just in those 2 pixels. That's all there is to it. So we can't tell if it occupies most of the 2 pixels or a little of the 2 pixels. It's still 2 pixels to the scintillation camera. So that doesn't help us. However, as the myocardium thickens, there is more myocardium within these 2 pixels. Since there's more myocardium, there's more counts, and the image becomes more intense. That's the partial volume effect. So when we have a small object that increases in size within the dimensions of the 2 pixels, we will see this as an increase in intensity. That's how we are able to assess wall thickening, by looking at intensification of the images. And this has been shown very, very nicely by investigators at Emory and other, is that we are actually very good at looking at wall thickening. So color images, because they allow us to look at changes in intensity very nicely, are very good at looking at wall thickening. EF 50%. All right, pacemaker. All right, pacemakers obviously can create a left bundle branch block pattern, so we can see the same thing. But sometimes the pacemaker leads are at the apex of the left ventricle, and there is retrograde conduction from the apex towards the base. And so therefore, the apex is out of sync with the rest of the ventricle. Let's take a look at this study. Perfusion, perfectly normal. There's the little, our little apical thinning, but totally normal perfusion scan. This teeny little defect at the apex. Let's take a look at function. My gosh, look at that apex. Use your cursor. It's dyskinetic. Again, apical dyskinesis, but normal perfusion. Why did this occur? Again, because the pacemaker is at the apex and there's retrograde conduction throughout the ventricle. What about thickening? This is pretty neat. Look at thickening during systole, 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 systole. The ventricle brightens during systole, but look at the apex. The apical brightening, it actually dims. It becomes less intense. That's because there is thinning of the apex because it's out of sync with the rest of the ventricle during systole. Okay. Here, EF37, markedly dilated ventricle. All right. Another circumstance where we have functional abnormalities without perfusion defects is in patients after open heart surgery, and we see a lot of post-CABG patients. Why is that? Well, during open heart surgery, you split the anterior pericardium. Normally, the pericardium sort of holds in the heart. Normally, there's an anterior swinging motion of the heart because of the ballistic motion of ejection of blood out the aorta, which is posterior. So the blood's ejected out the aorta, and there's a ballistic anterior motion of the heart, just like you shoot a rifle, okay? But that's limited by the anterior pericardium. You split the anterior pericardium during heart surgery, and the heart is no longer tethered. It just moves like crazy. It swings anteriorly. And so therefore, the inward motion of the septum is counterbalanced by the anterior ballistic motion of the heart. In contrast, the inward contraction of the posterior wall is exaggerated by the anterior swinging motion of the heart. So you get septal hypokinesis and lateral hyperkinesis in post-CABG patients. With right ventricular volume or pressure overload, you know this very well from echocardiography, there is a restrictive abnormality on the septum. The septum can't relax because of the increased pressure and volume of the right ventricle, and so forth. Therefore, the septum gets flattened and there's decreased diastolic excursion, but it doesn't affect perfusion. Okay. Let's look at the other side of the coin. Let's look at perfusion abnormalities without corresponding functional abnormalities. Artifacts. Okay, we've been through this. You have a fixed defect due to breast attenuation, but it moves and thickens normally. Your classic example. Gated imaging, as we've talked about, can be very helpful. If you have a scar, it's hypokinetic and akinetic or akinetic, and it has decreased or absent wall thickening. Attenuation artifacts have normal wall motion and normal wall thickening. And it's been shown by Beller and also Ty Fair that we can very significantly increase our specificity in assessing myocardial perfusion defects by adding gating just in this setting. All right, here we have an example. Vertical long axis images, dilated ventricle, moderate inferior perfusion defect. Here, short axis images, moderate to marked inferior perfusion defect. Is this an inferior scar? Or is it diaphragmatic attenuation? Or maybe some attenuation by the dilated cardiac blood pool? Tough to say. According to quantitative analysis, it's 5 standard deviations below normal. Must be abnormal. Function? Completely normal. This is a patient with a very elevated left hemidiaphragm. So gating can be very helpful in differentiating scar from artifact. However, let's look at some other circumstances. Exercise or pharmacologic stress-induced ischemia. This is perhaps going to be the most important thing of this lecture. All right. We get a stress-induced perfusion abnormality. It's not present at rest. So we have a reversible perfusion defect. There at stress, not at rest. We gate our stress images. What is our gated images? What are our gated images going to show? We're going to see a stress-induced wall motion abnormality? No. We are acquiring our gated images 40 minutes post-stress. Any stress-induced wall motion abnormalities will have resolved by that time, and at the time we acquire the images, wall motion will be normal. You know, with stress echo, you got to get the patient under the transducer in 3 minutes, or you don't have a valid study. We're not even starting the image acquisition until 40 minutes later. Now, what about post-stress stunning? Yes, in a very small minority of patients, these stress-induced wall motion abnormalities that obviously occur, you see them with echo, persist 30, 40, 60, 120 minutes. That's post-stress stunning. But it's a relatively rare phenomenon occurring maybe in about 5%, 3% of patients, generally with severe ischemia. So remember, the rule is with stress-induced ischemic abnormalities, wall motion and wall thickening will be normal. Okay, subendocardial infarction. This is a problem. Here we may have a perfusion abnormality, a mild to moderate perfusion abnormality due to a subendocardial infarct, but wall motion is still preserved because of the normally contracting mid and outer myocardium. So we can't differentiate subendocardial infarcts from perfusion defects with normal motion and artifacts. That's one of the limitations of myocardial perfusion imaging. That's where MRI has a big advantage. But you need the history, you need the ECG to help you with that. Okay, another one, tethering of scarred myocardium. Okay, myocardium that's scarred, you know, we see a perfusion defect, we should see a wall motion abnormality. Pretty easy. But sometimes that scar is tethered or being pulled in by the adjacent normally contracting myocardium. So you'll see normal wall motion. Okay, let's take a look. All right, here's a perfusion defect in the lateral wall. It's pretty much fixed, maybe a little bit reversible, but a severe perfusion defect in the basal half of the lateral wall. Okay, quantitative analysis, here's the defect. Let's take a look at the gated study. Well, it's moving in. Looks like normal wall motion. Now, if you've got a really good eye, maybe you might say that that's a little tardy kinetic. Maybe it's a little delayed in coming in. But at the end of the day, it moves. So we've got normal wall motion. But remember, there are two things we want to look at to ascertain that a defect is a scar: normal wall motion and also normal wall thickening. So let's take a look at wall thickening. Well, you see the rest of the myocardium is thickening. That doesn't thicken very well. So there's decreased wall thickening. This lateral wall is being tethered or pulled in by the adjacent contracting myocardium. This is work from Tracy Faber at Emory. This is a study of surface map looking at perfusion, wall motion, and wall thickening. Perfusion, big defect here at the apex. Wall motion, normal wall motion, absent wall thickening. Very nice example. Here is a scar of the apex that is being tethered or pulled in by the adjacent contracting myocardium. Actually, I think this is pretty rare at the apex, but this is the example that she showed, and it's quite dramatic. All right, what about errors in quantifying left ventricular function? We've talked about some of these, but there are more. arrhythmia with excessive beat rejection. Okay, let's examine how we do this. All right, as Lindsay's mentioned to you, when we gate a study, the first thing we do is we hook the patient up to the ECG and we monitor the patient for about 20, 30 seconds and we determine the average R-to-R interval, okay? And then we set what's called a 100% window, which is a terrible term, I hate this. It's really a plus minus 50% window. And for this is gated perfusion imaging, not blood pool imaging. So we take the average R-to-R interval and accept all the beats that are as much as 50% below it and as much as 50% above that average. So here I've diagrammed it. Let's say our mean, let's say the patient's heart rate is 60, so your mean R-to-R interval is 1,000 milliseconds, okay? So we will accept everything from 500 milliseconds, 50% below it, up to 1,500 milliseconds. Anything in that range will be accepted. Anything shorter or longer than that interval is going to be rejected. It doesn't get into the camera. You never see it. It's rejected beats. Okay. So unfortunately, this does not rotate. So I'm sorry about that. One of the WMVs didn't come through. But you see this here. These are the sequential frames of a 64 frame acquisition. So just imagine this image rotating around. Well, some of the frames you see everything, the heart, you know, the bowel, everything very well. And then in other frames, they're dropped out. Then you see it again, then you don't see it. Well, what's happening in these frames that are dropped out? Beats are being rejected because they are outside of this plus minus 50% window. Remember, people call this 100% window, but it's really plus minus 50% window. So these frames are gone. You no longer have this data. So what does this do? Well, you can get perfusion artifacts, but they're generally due to the fact that your images are of now low count density. You've rejected beats. So now, instead of having a very high count density study, you have lower count density study. And as you know, lower count density studies are noisy and they have a lot of artifacts. And so that's how you get artifacts. So this is a little experiment done by Ken Nichols. This is an acquisition that has 100% acceptance of beats. Looks very normal. Here's what happens when he rejected 50% of the cardiac cycles. Now you can see in the bullseyes, they're very noisy. And because of this noise, we're winding up getting perfusion abnormalities. So it's difficult. So this is what the problem we get into. It's not so much that we're creating artifacts, but we have low count density images. And that's what causes us problems with irregular beat rejection. Okay. Everything I said is true, but a lot of the modern cameras now have what's called dual windowing. So they are very smart. They know this problem's going to occur. So they do one acquisition that's gated, and simultaneously they do another acquisition that's non-gated. So if you have a lousy gated study, well, you have a lousy gated study, and maybe you can't assess wall motion and ejection fraction, but you have preserved all the counts of the myocardial perfusion scan in your non-gated acquisition. So you still have a really good non-gated acquisition to assess perfusion. That's called dual windowing. If you don't have it and you reject a lot of beats, you have to wind up reacquiring the study non-gated. Okay, the other problem we have with gating is variability of the R-to-R interval of the accepted beats. Now, these are the beats that fall within our plus minus 50% window. We've accepted them, okay? The problem is of all these accepted beats, what we do is we line them up of the initial R wave. So we're hoping that they all will occupy this 8 bins that we've selected for gating. But they don't. Some of them are shorter. Some of them are longer. One of them might be 1,200 milliseconds. One of them might be 600 milliseconds. So clearly, if we line them all up at the initial R wave, they're not all going to fill up the 8 bins. So what happens is the 7th or 8th frame gets dropped, or you have decreased count density because the short cycles don't fill up your bins. And here's an example of that. Systole looks pretty good. Systole. But look what happens in diastole. At the end of diastole, the last frames sort of drop out. And that's because of variability of the R to R interval of the accepted beats. Okay. We have problems with gating errors. We can gate on the, just like I mentioned to you with gated blood pool imaging, we have problems with gating on the T wave, the P wave, et cetera, et cetera. Here's an example. This study looks pretty good. Nice quality, perfectly normal images, no flashing, no rejected beats. Looks great. Beating images. Looks very nice, okay? But let's take a look a little more carefully at our volume curve, upside down. Here's the ejection fraction's 58, it's really negative 58. What happened? We gated on the T waves. Here's the patient's electrocardiogram, and you see relatively small R waves and tall T waves. So this was gating on the T wave. So did it make any difference clinically? Probably not, because the EF is 58%. But just to show you the problem we can encounter, and here's the volume curve. All right, here's another example. All right, here's this acquisition. A tiny bit of flashing, but very nice study. Images, excellent quality. But we do have this apical defect here. Is this apical thinning? Looks a little bit big for apical thinning, a little severe. Also, the ventricle looks dilated. Really need the gated study to determine if this is moving and what the ejection fraction is in this patient. Just this little apical defect. Here's the gated study. What's happening here? Well, not much. You sort of have the initial frame and then it just all disappears. So before you all get nauseous, let me move this around. Well, it's something I told you about in the gated blood pool lecture. It's gating on the T wave and the R wave. So from the R to the T, remember that's systole, and from the T to the R, that's diastole. We average this together and we get a flat line. Well, that would give us a 0% ejection fraction, but it also give us no images. All right, software errors. I mentioned this before. We have problems in identifying the valve plane. Why don't we? There's no myocardium there. So the software has to be very creative in guessing or figuring out where the valve plane is. To make matters worse, there is a problem with depth-dependent resolution. This is, if you all go to these sessions in this meeting, you will hear lots and lots about resolution recovery to increase our resolution with depth. But as structures get deeper, they're less well seen. They get blurrier. They're not as well resolved. And the deepest part of the heart is the valve plane. So we have problems seeing the valve plane. So that is problematic. And so here's an example. This happens to be QPS. Or QGS rather, the myocardium ends somewhere here, but look where they've selected the valve plane, way back here in outer space. Another problem with valve plane selection is in miscalculating TID. Here's a stress study, and the valve plane is way back here, past the left ventricle. Here at rest, the valve plane's just about where it should be. Well, clearly, one of these is wrong, but importantly is stress is bigger than rest, and we wind up with a TID ratio of 1.12, giving us, quote, pseudo-TID. Also, I mentioned this before, if we don't have any myocardium, it's hard to find the endocardial borders, like that case with the myocardial infarct I showed you before. And what also can happen is if you have activity outside of the heart, the program will go grab that activity, let's say in the stomach or the liver, rather than the inferior wall. And another problem with QGS, here's the, this should be the heart, but look what's happening here. Here it's going and grabbing the right ventricle. Here it's grabbing the subdiaphragmatic activity. So obviously very erroneous detection of the endocardial borders, but if you look at the wire model, looks pretty good. Look at the volume curve, looks pretty good. But it's completely erroneous because what you're tracking is not really the left ventricle. All right. We can also underestimate the left ventricular cavity. When does that occur? If our images are of low resolution, they tend to be blurrier, and therefore it's harder to define the endocardium, particularly at end systole. This can occur in small hearts. Here's a patient with a very small ventricle, little lady. Well, where's the endocardial border? I don't see it. So the error that the software makes is tend to underestimate end-systolic volume. Here you have an end-systolic volume of 7 cc's and an ejection fraction of 89%. We know this is an inherent error in gated perfusion imaging because of our limited spatial resolution. We tend to underestimate end-systolic volume and overestimate ejection fraction. That's why it's recommended that you don't report these high ejection fractions. You just say ejection fraction greater than 70% or greater than 75%. Another problem is if you have a low-energy radiopharmaceutical, i.e. thallium. Thallium, as you know, is less well-resolved than technetium. There have been plenty of studies, including one from my lab here, where we compared gated thallium and gated technetium sestamibi ejection fractions. And actually, they correlate pretty well. The R value here is around 0.93. However, the kicker is if you look at the intercept of thallium ejection fractions on the y-axis, MIBI ejection fraction on the x-axis, you see that the intercept is here around about 12%. So thallium tends to overestimate the ejection fraction, again, because of blurring of the endocardial border, particularly at end systole, underestimating end systolic volume, overestimating ejection fraction. Last but not least, temporal smoothing. We talked about this with gated blood pool imaging. Remember, if you have a low count density study, your left ventricular volume curve tends to be very ratty, and you smooth it by adjusting counts to the neighbors, i.e. bringing high count density frames low and very low count density frames up. And so here's an example. This is an 8-frame per cardiac cycle curve, and you can see it's sort of jumpy. This is a low count density study, you know, not real nice and smooth. Okay, you wind up with an ejection fraction of 68%. How do we improve our temporal resolution? We increase the number of frames. So we go from 8 frames to 16 frames. And in doing that, now we have much better temporal resolution, a much nicer looking left ventricular volume curve. This allows us to call end diastole higher. Instead of at 62, it's up to 70. End systole, instead of at 20, it's down here to about 18. And this drops our raises our ejection fraction from 68 to 74%. So the advantage of doing 16-frame gating is it gives you better temporal resolution and a higher ejection fraction. What's the downside of course, the count density is only half. You've cut the counts in half, and therefore your image quality is poorer, and it's harder to visually assess regional wall motion abnormalities. So it's a trade-off. In our lab, we prefer 8 frames because I would rather see the wall motion abnormality better than get a slightly more accurate ejection fraction, but the choice is yours. This is a study in the by Navari et al., basically looking at the differences between 8-frame and 16-frame gated images. This is diastolic volume, systolic volume, and ejection fraction. If you look at 16-frame gating, you can see that the diastolic volumes are higher, the systolic volumes are lower, and the ejection fraction is higher by about 5 percentage points. Probably not clinically significant. So hopefully that gives you some guidance on where you can use your gated images, and certainly clinically, and also some pitfalls in using gated images clinically. Thank you.